This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava in Washington. Neil Conan is on assignment in London. As part of their opposition to a U.S. war with Iraq, France and Germany this week have been floating a plan that would beef up weapons inspections in Iraq. The Bush administration already has dismissed such calls for more robust weapons inspections as beside the point. Here in the U.S., there have also been proponents of giving inspections another chance. And among those proponents is Jessica Tuckman Matthews, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And she joins us here in the studio. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
And we welcome your calls today as well about this issue of inspections. Can they still work? Would they make a difference? How much more time should Iraq get to show that it's complying with the inspections? Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, the email address. TOTN@NPR.org. Well, Jessica Matthews, this past week in the Washington Post on Sunday, you outlined a proposal for more robust inspections. And I'd like you to go through that point by point here for what you were talking about in your proposal as a way to make inspections work rather than go to war right away. The first thing you suggest is to, you say, put the right people in the field.
Right. In Resolution 1441, which was the UN resolution under which this is all happening, it said in it that it directed the inspection teams to hire the most qualified and experienced experts available, which sounds like pretty anodyne words, pretty obvious. But in fact, those words decoded mean two very specific things. First, usually the UN has to hire to get to achieve geographic diversity, an even spread, rather than particular technical expertise. And most qualified meant no, find the most qualified, the right technical expertise available. And that hasn't been done. And even more important, the word experienced meant there are only one class of experienced people, and that is people who participated in the earlier UN inspections called UNSCOM in the 90s. Because these folks have been trained to deal with Iraqi deception. They know how to confront it. They know the field. They know the actual physical places that they need to look. And they've also been trained in interrogation techniques, in how to catch the Iraqis in lying and how to extract the truth. But unfortunately, the UNSCOM experts are all sitting in television and radio studios explaining to us what should be going on, because in the past, the Iraqis, for the obvious reasons, have objected to them coming back and called them spies. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing that has to happen is that Mr. Blix has to get very tough, ignore that, and get those folks back there and out into the field.
How is it that the Iraqis could call the shots on that and say, well, we don't want these people here who have had the experience?
Well, of some years ago, there was a prior effort to reconstitute the inspections at a time when the major powers were very, very split, and they passed a very weak resolution, which actually several of the big powers abstained on, and it was a bad resolution. It accepted, in effect, the Iraqis' argument that or that they should be able to veto the names of particular inspectors. And it almost implicitly bought the argument that in the past some of them had acted as spies. But at any rate, it gave Baghdad, because of the weakness among the big five, the initiative on who got to be inspectors. And that was one of the things that was wiped off the table, as it should have been, by 1441.
Mm-hmm. So your first point here is to get the people who had experience out of the TV studios
and into the field.
Into the field.
Right. And, I mean, Mr. Blix has to understand that the essence of what is in 1441 is a totally different regime in which you don't negotiate with Iraqis, you don't try to reach agreement with them, you tell them what's going to happen, and you say, take it or leave it. Here are the new rules.
Right. Well, let's move on. On your list, the other part of your robust inspections would be to get the U-2s flying.
Yeah. This, too, is allowed or was called for under 1441 because the U-2 planes are the uniquely effective, most important tools of inspection because, unlike satellites, they stay in place. They don't go circling in orbit. And they are able to detect things above ground, underground, high resolution, broad coverage, really everything. So U-2s, and now with the improved technology, unmanned drones are really the key. And part of the reason why so little has been achieved to date, the biggest part was that there's been so little time, but the other part is that they haven't even attempted the most sensitive sites because the U.S. and others didn't want them to until there were surveillance planes flying. And since they had gotten into negotiations with the Iraqis about the U-2s, which they should never have done, they mm-hmm. should just say, they're going to be flying. If you want to tail them, you do so at your own risk. If there's any physical intervention, any obstruction of any kind, that's the end.
And that's a provocation for war.
Right. So. And if you follow the U-2s into the no-fly zones, you will be shot down by the Americans and the British. You know, it has nothing to do with us, the UN. That's a separate thing. So that seems now, although I gather that today even there's some question about whether the Iraqis have put conditions, but that seems to be on its way to being resolved.
And this dovetails with the idea of the no-fly and no-drive zones in Iraq.
No, that's a separate thing, because that would require new additional authority that does not exist under 1441 and new force structure. The U-2s are just surveillance. Mm-hmm. But what Secretary Powell showed in his UN speech was Iraqi's ability to play games with material, to move it, to take things out, to sanitize sites, etc. Well, the way to put a stop to that, first of all, is to impose what we call no-fly zones and no-drive zones, no-drive being military vehicles.
Which you can monitor with your U-2s or
you can monitor, but you have to enforce it with fighter planes. And to do it over broad areas of Iraq, not just specific sites, but broad areas that the inspectors would designate, requires a force about 2 to 3 times as big as the forces that we have had there for years and years enforcing the no-fly zones over northern and southern Iraq, mm-hmm. over the Kurdish regions and the southern regions. Right now, we've got about twice as much as we had before, so we're already in the ballpark where we can do that. But what would be important, first, to shut down this Iraqi gameplay.
The shell game.
But also to do this would allow other countries to demonstrate their conviction and their commitment to disarm and to using force to disarm Saddam, countries that don't want to contribute force to an invasion to unseat him, mm-hmm. but are committed to disarmament. So you create a force of which, you know, 90% of the flying power is American and 10% is British or something, but it becomes a multilateral force in which others play in a very important political role, if not an important military one.
Would these be what we would call peacekeepers, or is this a whole other animal from peacekeepers? Because that has been floated in the past week as well about put UN peacekeepers in there.
Peacekeepers are forces on the ground. Mm-hmm. This is a form of coercive force that does not involve shooting. And basically what you say to the Iraqis is any form of interference with these planes, if you send a pea shooter at one of them, that will be the end of inspections and will trigger war. And, this regime is a classic bully. They go after weaker opponents, not stronger ones. They make a lot of noise, a lot of bluster. They did that before in the early 90s. They protested every single day the U-2s flew, formal protest, but they never touched them mm-hmm. because they had been told if you touch them, you will get attacked. And that's the way we have to approach this going forward.
Right. You're also calling here for destroying any site that has been sanitized.
Right. I mean, you remember those very vivid pictures that Secretary Powell showed of the chemical weapons storage site where you could see before and after photos of, and with the clear indication that things had been moved, and another site that had been bulldozed. Another way you put an end to this sort of de facto obstruction is you say any evidence that we have of sanitizing a site, cleaning it out, we will take as prima facie evidence of banned activity, and that will call for the destruction of the site. It's that simple. We know what's going on. We know why it's going on. So we're here to find and destroy banned activities. So that's what will happen.
It sounds, so far with what you're describing here, that it's so many more, it's more rules, more codified, more, to borrow an expression from a decade ago, more lines in the sand of this is what we want to do, and if you don't let us do it, that we're telling Iraq, with what you're proposing with this plan for stronger inspections, well, then we that will be a provocation for force.
I would describe it differently. It is the first selective application of military force to the inspections process. And so it changes the nature of the inspection process in a very fundamental way. But it also does something else, which is to underline what it says in 1441, but which there is still grave doubt around the world about American policy, which is our aim here is disarmament, not regime change. And we are going to use military force selectively in this case to achieve that disarmament and to tip the odds in the favor of the inspectors, who are, after all, trying to clean up a very large country, and to make the use of our technology and stuff to not just to even the playing field, but to tip it in our direction, mm-hmm. but to make it very clear that the end result is disarmament, not regime change.
Let's go to Marshall, who is in Bend, Oregon. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. I actually saw your guest on the Oprah show. I believe she was on last week. And what I wanted to ask is, it feels like the regime change is inevitable. It feels like Bush is going to go to war no matter what we do. So it feels like we're spinning our wheels with this type of conversation. And I want to know, just being the peace activist that I am, what can we do moving forward? What can we do to be proactive? We're under the assumption this is going to happen.
Well, I guess it's hard for me to answer because I don't buy your assumption. I think that what was striking about Secretary Powell's speech was that he didn't try to make the case that there was an imminent threat, and he certainly didn't make that case. He made the case that inspections were being evaded, and that this was we have solid evidence of reason to be concerned about weapons of mass destruction. But at the end, he left it hanging. He left hanging the question of, okay, what next? And so and we have to remember that there is overwhelming global opposition to a war. And you have to also assume what we're already seeing with the elevation of the alert status to orange, that U.S. planners are very well aware that this war brings with it an enormously enhanced risk of terrorist attacks on the U.S. So mm-hmm. there are very powerful reasons why they would be looking for alternatives to an all-out war. And indeed, I believe that they are. Now, whether it will turn out that way, none of us have any way of knowing. But if I were you, I would not take it as a given. You have to understand that a lot of the administration's rhetoric is directed at scaring Saddam Hussein and making him feel that it's inevitable, rather than a reflection of a settled decision.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I do hope you're right. I hope you're right. If there were a side, I'm on your side. I want to be proactive that if it does happen, if the war does start, what can we do? What can we do to voice our opinion, to come together as a group, as a nation, as the people who don't want this to happen, and how do we voice this opinion?
I think once the war starts, it's too late. You need to voice your opinion. I'd say writing the White House. It does make a difference.
Well, thanks for your call, Marshall, and we welcome your calls, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. We're talking about the possibility of more robust weapons inspections in Iraq as an alternative for going to war. We're talking about whether they would work, and we will get back after this short break. I'm Melinda Penkava. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington, and we're talking about weapons inspections in Iraq and whether you think longer or tougher weapons inspections would be useful and how tough and how long should they be. What would happen also at the end of that time if Iraq were still not disarmed? You can give us a call here at 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And our guest here in Studio 3A is Jessica Matthews, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She wrote an article in this past Sunday's Washington Post called "Is There a Better Way to Go?" And we've been talking about several points in there of the more robust inspections that Jessica Matthews is proposing here. Another one that you're calling about is not letting lethal items get away from there.
Right.
That just seems common sense, but that's not been happening?
No, because there has been no way for the inspectors to call on force. I mean, another thing that, I mean, just to back up a step, in your introduction, you said whether inspections should be given another chance. And, mm-hmm. of course, a lot of people are phrasing it that way. But one of the things that we pointed out in a study that the endowment released 2 weeks ago now, I guess, is that inspections had barely begun. And what, in fact, was the reason, the motivation one could have for pulling the plug on them when they'd barely gotten started. We pointed out that the first helicopter, which are essential for no-notice inspections outside of downtown Baghdad, didn't arrive until January 5th. Mm. That the first bit of intelligence sharing by the U.S. did not happen until the end of the first week of January. That the teams are not even up to full strength, even forgetting the question of whether the right people are there. That overhead surveillance had not begun. So all of those measures showed that this was a process that had barely started. Secretary Rumsfeld had described it as having been exhausted, but in fact it had barely begun, mm-hmm. when Mr. Blix made his speech to the UN on the 28th, 27th. So to get back to your specific questions about things getting away, inspectors, what we can do is we have some information from satellites, as Secretary Powell mentioned, that biological warheads had been taken and stored in the western deserts of Iraq. But, you know, by the time inspectors can get there, they'll be gone, mm-hmm. right? So one thing one could do, if out in the desert, if you know that you're tracking warheads and they're going to be moved again, is don't look for things twice. When you find them, destroy them. And that way, if you don't have inspectors right there, and this is far from Baghdad and they can't get there, use air power.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Roger in San Francisco. Welcome, Roger.
Yes, and thank you. You know, I certainly do agree with the German and the French. I believe that a more robust inspection would be a good thing. It's obvious to me that Iraq does not want war. The Security Council, 4 out of 5 members of the Security Council, does not want war. I think what we have here is a trap we created for ourselves. George Bush has been putting troops in there for months now. He's put himself in a box. I would like to remind the administration, you've already won. There wouldn't have been inspections from day one if you didn't have those troops there. You're not going to lose face if you pull back. In fact, you will create more of a problem for this nation if you attack. You will weaken the United Nations. You will weaken NATO. You will cause a massive disruption in the world. You will encourage terrorists. You will split our own country. I'm going to participate in another demonstration here in San Francisco on Sunday against this war.
Would you oppose any military action against Iraq? Say, and I haven't even asked Jessica yet, what time certain we would put on inspections if this isn't accomplished by X date, mm-hmm. Would there be justification? First, you, Roger, would you always oppose any military action against Iraq if these inspections that Jessica's proposing turned up evidence that Saddam is not disarmed?
If the inspections turns up evidence that he's been lying and he has intentions to violate what was passed, I certainly would not oppose war. This man is dangerous, but going to war with this man may be more dangerous. If you declaw the man, he will be simply not capable of doing any damage. But the greater danger out there is the root causes we have to go after the root causes in the Middle East for all this dissension. And if we could only, if I could only ask the president to look at it, just take a broader picture here. You will do more for peace. We're losing old friends. Saudi Arabia has already mentioned that once they resolve this issue, they're going to ask our troops to be removed from their land. Jordan is in great danger. It's allowing bases in there, I understand. Mm-hmm. That's a population of, their population is made up of Palestinians, more than the majority. So it's long range. It's very dangerous. I just hope that the president will look at the picture in the broadest sense. He'll get a, if he attacks, of course he'll win, but he may lose in the long run.
Well, Roger, thank you so much for your call. 1-800-989-8255 is the number, 1-800-989-TALK. And joining us now on the phone from his office in Washington is William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard and author of the just published The War Over Iraq. Welcome, Bill Kristol.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, I take it you have some problems with this proposal for more coerced inspections.
Well, no, it's a good idea. It would have been an excellent thing to have done in 1998 when Saddam booted out the first round of inspectors. I think it's frankly too late now. I mean, it can't be done. Saddam won't agree to it. There's no evidence that, incidentally, the French or the Germans or anyone else will agree to it either. And more importantly, it just can't work. I mean, there's no evidence in history of coercive inspections working against the wishes of a tyrannical government that controls the country and that is deeply committed to having chemical and biological weapons and developing nuclear weapons. So I think it's just too late.
Well,
Jessica Matthews?
There's about eight different logical inconsistencies in there. I mean, if it would have been a good thing to do...
Four or five? Eight?
All right, let's say four. if it had been a good thing to do in 1998, why is it that it wouldn't work now?
Because he's had 4 years with no inspections.
So, I mean, the inspectors...
And the old inspections only worked when defectors led us to things.
No, that's just, actually, Bill, that is not true.
And that is true.
No, it isn't true. I mean, if you think that, you're not informed.
I think the same thing that the old inspectors think. That David Kay thinks and Rolfe Ikeas thinks.
No.
What is that, Bill, just to crystallize for us?
The key discoveries they made were not made with the Iraqi government resisting and hiding, that in the early days after we won the war and we had them intimidated, they handed over some things, and in the later days, everything important we got was from defectors.
It's just wrong. It's just flatly wrong. I could tell you, Rolf and I wrote this first report together, and I happen to know the facts on this. The biological weapons program, which the administration, until Secretary Powell's speech finally a week ago, had been saying over and over and over that the BW program had been discovered only because of a defector. The defector that in question defected in August. Ambassador Ikeas first described in detail the BW program to the Security Council in an open session in April of the prior April. It's just it is a factual error that the president and the secretary have repeated over and over and over again, which they finally got right last week. But the facts are, and Ambassador Ikeas will tell you this if you ask him, that UNSCOM, over a period of 6 years, discovered and uncovered most of a 20-year prior effort on Iraq's part of building these weapons. We now have to uncover a 4-year period. It's a much easier job with much bigger resources.
Right. Well, Bill Kristol, I do want to move forward on this.
No serious person believes that 300 or 1,000 inspectors can uncover anything in a country the size of California or France.
So
now, if Jessica wants to put 100,000 troops in there, which is her last resort, I mean, I'm for that, but if we're going to put 100,000 troops in there, we might as well liberate the Iraqi people.
No.
Well, you did say, you were suggesting, Jessica, that to put troops on the ground in your proposal in the Post.
Creating bases in the far corners of Iraq to support troops, to support inspections that are very far from Baghdad. But
so we're going to have troops on the ground there, but Saddam gets to be this unbelievably tyrannical dictator, and UN and U.S. troops stand by and watch him oppress his people?
The question is, what is in our interest? And what is in our interest, in my view, national security interest, where are American people safer, is not invading Iraq for the purpose of regime change.
Bill Kristol, what if the idea of having more robust inspections, putting that in place now, having a time certain on them, and if lines are crossed, if Iraq doesn't comply with that, if it shoots down U-2s, what have you, that are getting closer, to potential evidence, then there would be a very clear provocation of war, and then war would be an easier pitch elsewhere.
It wouldn't be an easier pitch. The French and the Germans have never said in that case war would be fine. We did go through this. We did have a UN Security Council resolution. No one doubts that Saddam is in flat violation of Resolution 1441. People who are against war are against war, as your earlier caller was, and I respect that position, incidentally. There is a coherent argument, I don't agree with it, that this is too risky a war, we can live with Saddam with weapons of mass destruction, we can deter him, we can contain him, too bad for the Iraqi people who've been brutalized, but let's be serious, if I can paraphrase your earlier caller, we can't afford to go to war, it's too risky, it'll destabilize the Middle East, it's not in the U.S. national interest, et cetera, et cetera. That is the authentic dovish argument. I deeply disagree with it, but it's an authentic argument. It is the notion that we could disarm Iraq with Saddam Hussein in power is a false middle ground. It's not going to happen. It hasn't happened over the last 3 months.
Well,
we can kick the can down the road for another 3 or 6 months, but then we still have to go to war. And incidentally, we can't leave 80,000 troops in the region. If you really want to destabilize the Arab world, if you really want to let the Saudi government fall, then let's try to leave 100,000 troops sitting around there for the next 6 months.
We go to war, they're going to stay there for a decade. Come on.
They're going to stay there and helping a free Iraq govern
itself. It doesn't matter. They're going to be...
That's very different from being...
They're going to be an occupying force.
But what about the...
Oh, they're going to be a force that's going to clean out the weapons of mass destruction and help liberate the Iraqi people.
I do have a question, though, for you, Jessica Matthews, on this idea of putting 180,000, 100,000 UN troops on the ground.
No, nobody's talking about anything.
What would the number be?
In the context, I mean... The original proposal for coercive inspections involved 50,000, but what I was suggesting in that article for those bases is a small number. It's to give ground support operating bases. That's a very small
but
number.
But practically speaking, I have seen at least one critique of this robust inspections plan say that then you put a lot of these people on the ground, whether they're the inspectors or those troops, and you're making instant potential hostages. If then the U.S. or whatever other forces decided, okay, there's the provocation to go in and attack Iraq, then you have a lot of these people on the ground.
That's true. This is not... It's true. It's not an easy thing to do. It does involve some new military doctrine. Bill's saying this has never worked before. That's a tautology. It's never been tried before. The question is, if you compare this option to the risks of a war for the purpose of regime change, where is national security best served? I believe that if you balance the costs of doing this against the risks of an escalation to weapons of mass destruction, use of Israel being pulled into this war, which is the first thing Saddam will try to do, of increased terrorist response against the U.S., which is almost certain, of the war proving to be a potent recruiting tool for al-Qaeda, and for the long-term costs of trying to occupy and politically reconstruct Iraq, a task for which the American public is totally unprepared, that will take something like a minimum of 50,000 troops for 5 to 10 years. If you make that balance, it comes clearly in favor of trying to see if you could do it through inspection.
And we're talking with Jessica Matthews and Bill Kristol today on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to the phones. We have Bakir in Woodbridge, Virginia. Welcome, Bakir.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I have certain proximity to the situation. I am from Turkey, even though I am a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. My country is forced into war with a neighbor with which it lived in peace for hundreds of years, and suddenly we are told that we are under an imminent danger, and if we don't eliminate our next door country or do not participate in that, and we are at peril, our IMF loans will not be approved, and we are not going to be part on the table, etc. Mm-hmm. And it is made by threat or by bribe a party into a war that it does not want to get into.
What do you think of the idea of more inspections that Jessica Matthews is talking about?
Well, you know, one thing that is missing in all the debate on in all the media, unlike the debate that's going on that I hear from Americans, there's a huge divide. The divide is because of this. Now, the United States have sufficient weapons of mass destruction to take the world off of the orbit of the sun. It has more than 40,000 nuclear weapons. It has invented all these weapons of mass destruction.
Right. So what does? But what do you think about the? What do you think about the inspections? Bakir,
who gave the United States the moral authority to dictate 8,000 mile away country what weapons it can have?
Okay, I'm going to put that. Bill Kristol, a response to that.
Well, we have. I think. I mean, it's so obvious, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, you know, would the world be better off? I mean, Jessica, I think, agrees with this. Her plan is an attempt to remove weapons of mass destruction from Saddam. Presumably the reason for doing that is that it is unacceptably dangerous to let a tyrannical dictator who has gassed his own citizens, who is unbelievably brutal and aggressive and something of a risk-taker, have weapons of mass destruction. So then Jessica and I have a difference about how practical this beefed-up or coercive inspections regime would be. If you want to make the other case, which I guess this gentleman is making, that what business is it of ours? Well, fine. So what business is it of ours if Iran gets nukes and if Syria and Libya get nukes and if the North Korean situation gets out of control, which I'm afraid it is, and South Korea goes nuclear in Japan, Taiwan? I guess we're just supposed to sit here and say, hey, look, it's none of our business. Who are we to police the world? Every dictator and even every friendly country or democracy in the world will just let them have a chemical, biological, and nuclear arms race. That's not a world we can or should live. In, I think Jessica would probably agree with this, and the question then is how to stop it. I think with Saddam, we're at the point where military action is necessary, and I think we are, if we don't do it, no one will do it, and I think we're acting in our own interest, but really in the world's interest.
I think that there, I would draw a different, provide a different answer to the caller, and the reason, and that is, again, drawing the line between what right do we have vis-a-vis the weapons of mass destruction versus the decision that this is too evil a regime to be allowed to remain in power. On the former, we have a solid legal base, which is the violation of UN Security Council resolutions that came out of the fact that Iraq aggressed against Kuwait 10 years ago and lost the war. And therefore, and that is the reason, I think, that there is also broad international support for doing it on that basis. Where the world leaves us and where the legal basis is lost is on this other decision that somehow we can decide that he's too evil to be allowed to remain in power. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think there is such a deep and broad global opposition to this war.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jessica Tuckman-Matthews, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And thank you for joining us, Bill Kristol.
Sure.
Jessica Tuckman-Matthews is president of Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and William Kristol is editor of the Weekly Standard and author of the just published The War Over Iraq.